Welcome back to Dave's Gone By, and kind of happy and interested in having this guest with us tonight, live in the studio. He's a WGBB person and has been, not just for the past few months, but on and off for a couple of years now. And now don't suddenly run away or get weirded out when I tell you that he's a former cop and a detective, in fact, and I would say fairly conservative in his views. But he's also a really good dude, and he has amazing stories to tell of his life being an undercover detective in the 1970s and 80s, as well as a political candidate, a police chief, and also a consultant to certain foreign countries and their police forces. So we're going to go through all of this stuff with, well, some people have called him Tonto, and that's not in the Spanish way of meaning stupid at all. It has to do with the Lone Ranger and Tonto, of which he was part back in the 70s as a police team. Please welcome Lou Talano. Hey, Lou.
Dave, thank you. Thanks. Thank you for having me as your guest.
Yeah, well, it's good. I mean, I've heard your show a few times on, well, several times on WGBB, because you're on Sunday nights.
Yes.
And so, you know, at first I was like, oh, okay, they've got this policeman and he's talking with two political candidates. And then you start having, like, these really interesting folks on. And then you started telling me about your life as a detective. And suddenly I was like, wow, this guy's actually pretty darn interesting.
I got a habit doing that. I'm a little ham when it comes to that. You know, I say I'm... Most people say I'm a pretty quiet guy, but when you can suck me in or get me joining when you start talking about cop stuff. I hope you didn't scare some of your audience away when you said, don't run away because we have a cop on. That, you know, that might have caused some people to run away.
Well, yeah, but there's nothing else on the radio, so they might as well come back and listen
good.
To me.
And
so.
I'm glad you cleared up Tonto, because Tonto in Spanish does mean... You know, it does mean dumb, stupid.
Well, I'm sure American Indians complained when the Lone Ranger, well, if they had any political voice at all about that designation for the Lone Ranger, then, like, they knew what it meant, just nobody else did.
You know, it's you mentioned that, and my partner and I, because we were nicknamed the Lone Ranger and Tonto with the book, and we were on pretty much many of the talk shows in those days, we did meet with the person that played the Lone Ranger, Clayton Moore.
Oh, cool.
We had a meeting with him in New York, Biltmore Hotel. And then we also met with Jay Silverheels. They both passed away.
Well, yeah.
These are the gentlemen that actually were the movie and television people that play the Lone Ranger and Tonto.
Well, that's all right. See, that's one of the perks of having your life sort of Hollywoodized. I mean, the one thing I also didn't mention is that you, as Lone Ranger and Tonto, well, your partner and you, ended up becoming the progenitors of Starsky and Hutch on TV. So let's take it back to your becoming a cop. How, when, etc.
You know, I was born in an area called the Lower East Side.
I've heard of it, yeah.
Downtown Manhattan, you know, and most people have a choice in life when whether you're born in Brooklyn or the Bronx, and in my case, Lower East Side, you have a choice as a youngster. Do you want to be a bad guy or a good guy? You know, you can go in either direction. And, you know, I'm happy to say that I went in the right direction. And if I tell you why, I wanted to become a cop, you know, and some people say, why did you want to become a cop? And I say, well, because, believe it or not, I wanted to become a cop because of females and being conceited.
Oh, I thought that was the typical reason.
And that was, and that was probably it. And, you know, some of my friends that I was brought up with wound up doing their mafia thing. They wound up in the gangs and organized crime. Some believe it or not, and I shouldn't say that because it's not too hard not to believe, are still in jail. And to this day, life sentences. And, so there's a choice, and then, of course, there are some of the guys that went through college and became attorneys and doctors, and we still have reunions from the old neighborhood, the Lower East Side.
Any famous people who've gone on from, like, your neighborhood?
Yeah, if you could remember the crazy, not crazy, Eddie, Jerry, he used to sell... on television, the commercial.
Oh, that's the story.
That's the story. What's the story, Jerry?
Yeah.
Yeah, he's one of the people that came from that era. And there's a few others, I just can't think of top of my head. But I can tell you some of the people that were born down there, Eddie Cantor going way back.
Oh, well, yeah.
James Gagne, or Cagney, Cagney I should yeah. say, James Cagney. Al Jolson.
But you know, I meant in your circle, in your neighborhood.
No, I'm thinking of Jerry and a few other people, you know, not that became attorneys and doctors, but not, I wouldn't say, not with the exposure, I think, that I was fortunate enough to get for whatever reason.
So you became a police officer in, was it the late 50s or the 60s, or when was it?
Oh, actually in the 60s.
Okay.
I was still in school in the 50s. Now, we used to hang out on the corner of downtown New York, and there was a cop, a young cop, and, you know, guys were getting in trouble, but not compared to what the young guys do today. But we had a gang, and we used to look up to people like Al Capone, you know, and some of us looked up to people like Rocky Marciano, which was nice, a fighter. So I, as a result of my father being a boxing champ in the Navy, he got me into boxing, and that's why I never smoked. And he got me into jogging and working out, and I've been doing it ever since. So, I was able to build up some good values, and the guys were going out drinking and smoking and stuff like that. I can't say I didn't do it. I'd rather go to the gym. So I went into the Golden Gloves, and I became an amateur fighter.
How'd you do?
I've done that. Well, I was the PAL champ as a welterweight, and in the Parks Department, at that time I became middleweight champ. Two things ended my career. One is I started getting cauliflower ears, which, thank goodness, they went away. And when a girl brought it to my attention, what are those bumps on your ears? Right? And I said, so forget about it.
And the girls again.
Absolutely. And then we had a fighter friend of ours. His name was Georgie Flores. He was, I guess, 5 years older than me. And he was an amateur fighter and then went into the pro. He had 14 wins by knockouts. And he fought a fight where he beat this guy, Roger Donahue, who was a top contender in those days. By the way, he was the lighting engineer for Yankee Stadium, this Roger Donahue.
Oh, wow.
And then I had a rematch. When was the rematch? 2 weeks later. So he fought Roger Donahue again. He beat Roger Donahue, but Roger Donahue gave him what a beating, even though he lost. Bottom line is, a month later, Georgie Flores died.
Probably an aneurysm or something.
Aneurysm, correct. He went into a coma the next day, and he never woke up. And then my father said, that's it, no boxing career. No boxing career for you. Getting back to why I wanted to become a cop.
Yeah.
This young cop on the corner, his name was Angelo, and he would talk to us, and, you know, in those days, the cops, you know, they spoke to you with a nightstick. But he came over and said, look, I want to talk to you guys. Look, I come from the South Bronx, and I used to hang out on a corner like you guys. But let me tell you, some of the guys used to laugh and do gestures and things like that. And I would listen. And then I would see him on the corner, shoes were shined, well-groomed, and all the girls used to talk to him. He had more girls around him.
Yeah.
And I said, hey, this is a good job. You walk around with your pants pressed, nice and clean, you carry your gun, you're well-groomed, and all the girls are around you, right? So I says, and that was pretty much my first thought of...
I have to say, when I was in high school, one day towards, well, it must have been senior year, I think it was the Navy came to call, and they allowed them to come in for a class and talk about the options that people had of going into the armed forces. And so, you know, they gave their spiel, and a lot of the class, this being the late 1970s, was kind of, oh, yeah, like, because we had, luckily, most of us, the option of college or working for the parents, and it wasn't a financial necessity of going into the armed forces. But, of course, there were some kids who were kind of interested. But the first question wasn't about danger. It wasn't about... you know, the whether you get paid for college. It wasn't anything like that. The first question was, so do you have a girl in every port of call? And they said, yes. I mean, they were laughing, but that was, of course, it's the guys in uniform.
Absolutely. And, you know, and it's true, for whatever reason, girls like, young girls like guys in uniform. you know, and especially your sailor's uniform. You know?
But the irony is, you went in, you became a cop, I guess a street cop for a while, and then you had the exact opposite of, well, what we consider a uniform for a long time, because you went undercover, you became a detective.
Right, right. Well, I was fortunate. I hooked up with a fellow, John Seppi, who was the Lone Ranger, and we had sort of, we were like on the same wavelength. He was born and raised in East New York, Brooklyn, and again, I was raised downtown Manhattan. So we were not guys that were born and raised in suburbia. So we lived in tenement buildings. We hung out on the street corners. We sang a cappella. We did all those things. And so we interacted with a lot of bad guys. Guys that, you know, I would go in the yard somewhere, and we would see the guys cleaning their guns.
Oh, nice.
And, you know, and there were times when we were invited, you know, when I say we, him and his area, me and mine, and they would say, well, we're going to stick up a gas station uptown. Hey, Lou, do you want to come with us? And I, you know, and I'd say, no, it's, you know, or stick up a liquor store. And, you know, and then some of these guys graduated, when I say graduated, and, well, you know, wound up being in organized crime.
Right.
And some of the guys actually fell in love with that because they saw these guys with the gold watches, the big Cadillacs, again, with all the young girls, well, they were young themselves, but with all the women, and they didn't have to scrounge quarters in their pockets to take some girl out, you know, that had the big bucks.
It's the same as drug culture. It's about the bling. It's about having the Cadillac and being the pimp in all senses of, the modern senses of the word, because, you know, you need $1,000, you pull $1,000 bills out of your wallet, and there it is.
You know, it's a good analogy, and when my partner and I used to ask some of these kids, stealing pocketbooks from old ladies or stealing gold change, why don't you go out and, you know, and get a job? You know, we live in the same area you guys lived in, and, you know, some of the response was, well, you know, man, I get $50 a pocketbook, and sometimes $100 that's in a pocketbook, you know, even if it's $20. He said, I got to work for $35 a week or $50 a week. I got to work
then,
at McDonald's.
So, yeah.
I'll be, yeah, whatever, $50. I got to work all week for that at McDonald's. I can make that in 10 minutes out in the street, you know. And then, like you said, Dave, and some of the guys looked up, and you call them a pimp, and they rightfully are in their way, making big money selling drugs, have all the cash, but that's short-lived. You know, they wind up in jail or getting killed themselves, and that's the life. But some of these kids, that's who they're role models, you know.
Well, that was hip-hop and rap culture. I mean, that's where the gangster culture. But again, I wanted to get back to your going from a street cop, as it were, to go to volunteering for something a bit more dangerous, but I guess more interesting.
Well, you know, I had an advantage. Before I was a cop, I was a New York City correction officer, so I worked in the jails for several years. And that's an education. And some of the places like California, I think Los Angeles, or some of them, especially in the sheriff's department, you have to work a year in a jail before they send you out in the street. And you get an education, you know, in the jails. You know, you learn how to deal with the different types not people, different types of criminals. And so when I hit the bricks, start walking the beat, I was more observant. I you know, I could spot things, not only because of the neighborhood I came from, but also from being a correction officer. So I had an advantage to some of the guys that was in my class in the police academy, who came from suburbia. Volunteering and getting involved in working undercover and plain clothes was interesting, something that we liked and we enjoyed it. We got a kick out of it. In my case, in the 60s, the Tonto came in, pretty much the nickname, because I had hair down on my shoulders.
You weren't allowed to have that until you started going on
You do that undercover, correct.
Yeah.
Correct. I wore a headband. I'm probably one of the first guys to wear an earring.
Did you actually have to have your ears pierced, or was it a clip-on?
I had a clip-on with the long hair. Yeah, I didn't want to go that far. So, you know, so, and that's how it came about. And I used to, you know, go out in the street, and it was good for two reasons. besides enjoying it, during working undercover and going after drug dealers, which was our focus, not the drug addicts, although you get drug addicts first, and that leads you into the drug dealers, but you got guns off the street. And then if there were certain cases, homicide cases or major crimes, some of the people that you locked up with, you wouldn't even have to ask them. They say, look, you know, we could tell you who killed that old lady, you know, that lived in that building and that, you know. You listen to them, and of course you work with the district attorney, and you give them a break. But since it wasn't our thing, me and my partner, we would give it to the detectives, the leads, and they would follow it up. So it was good, because you really, it was a challenge, and it was rewarding. Hi, this is Lou Talano, and you're listening to Dave's Going By on WGBB.
What were some of the more dangerous, or I hate to use the word exciting, because that's kind of a wrongish word to use, but some of the heavier situations that you and your partner found yourselves in?
There were several of them, but one that pretty much stands out in my partner and both our minds is that we rented this apartment, pink houses in East New York, Brooklyn, and we got into the apartment, and there was three guys in the apartment, and you'd knock on the door, and you slip in a couple of bucks, $5 ever was, through the peephole, and they'd slip you a deck of heroin. So we did this for, I guess, 2, 3, 4 weeks, and then it was time to get the warrant, and four of us were going to hit the apartment, which we did. And when we rushed into the apartment, there was three guys in the apartment, and the two guys on the left of us, it was four of us, were holding two kids in their hands.
Oh, boy.
And they had their guns out. And the guy I chased ran into the bedroom. He pulls a baby out of the crib. And in the crib, he had an automatic weapon.
Okay.
So, and, you know, they say, you know, what's going on now? People say, well, why do cops react? Why do they shoot so much? How we held back without shooting this day is because of the children. Now, they were shooting at us.
Oh,
they were shooting at us.
And you had to shoot back then. You can't not shoot.
What if I tell you we didn't fire a shot? And it's so hard to believe we didn't fire a shot, Dave. And one of us got shot. When I say one of us, one of the guys did get shot.
Bad.
Actually, I should say, one guy was shot. No, it was shot in the thigh. Thank God it didn't hit the main artery that goes down your thigh. And one was hit pretty bad, believe it or not, with ricochet.
Huh.
Ricochet tore his stomach up. We didn't wear vests in those days.
Oh, right.
You know, before it was mandatory to wear vests. So we locked up these guys. And let me say we jumped them. We actually jumped them because they had the babies. The babies are screaming. They couldn't shoot accurately. You know, some of the guys were throwing things at them, you know, but nobody fired a shot from our side, you know. And the guy who grabbed the gun, he didn't get a chance to use his gun. Yeah. He just had it in his hand, and I tackled him and the baby. So I fell on top of the baby, and he's on his back. And by that time, I had my gun in his ear.
Good, yeah.
So by that time, and I had, it was, you know, to hold a baby and keep my gun in his ear and make sure he doesn't grab the gun is,
just pointed the gun at
so
the baby.
So a lot of people were saying, you know, they couldn't understand how come we didn't shoot any of them, you know? And, the bottom line is that all three of them did wind up in Brookdale Hospital, which was the closest hospital. And some were there for quite a while.
So, in other words, once you got them down on the ground, you gave them what we did,
what we had to do. And,
but see, in these days, you couldn't have gotten probably away with that second part of the story. They would say, well, you got them down on the ground. You know, you got to stop there.
You know, they could say that, you know, and it doesn't work like that. You know, it's through the years, I've noticed that, you know, with all these different cases, Abner Louima, Amadou Diallo, and say, why did these cops fire 50 times? Well, one of the shootouts that was to answer your question, that was one of the most traumatic incidents that we had. there was a time when we, and I can think, I remember the year because they were laying off cops. It was 1975, and they laid off a bunch of police officers. And even though we were detectives, we had a ride in a marked police car, even though we were in suits and ties. And that was to, you know, as a deterrent, to show there's still police coverage out there.
Cool.
It was, could have been cosmetics, but it was, it's politics.
It doesn't
it's
hurt.
Politics
also.
As usual.
Yeah.
And you're right, David, it doesn't hurt. So we're out there patrolling in a marked car. And while we're in there, we see a guy running across the street holding his head. He's bleeding. And then in front of him was a guy carrying, you could see it's a night deposit bag. And we saw a gun in his hand. We jump out. We have a shootout with him. And it's one of the things that you were just reading. It says Wild West story in Brooklyn. That's so. So we had a shootout with this guy, and he ran into a building. By that time, we had got on the radio. There was backup. John, my partner, John Seppi, emptied his gun. I emptied my gun.
Wow.
And we didn't carry automatics on them, but we did carry our two revolvers. So we had an off-duty revolver and a regulation revolver. So we carried both guns.
Right.
So the guns only held, the regulation 6 rounds, the off-duty 5 rounds. Today they have double that in one automatic weapon. So when we got him into the precinct, he was in the precinct downtown where we had the incident with him. He's in the cell and he says, "Hey man, I don't feel good. What's the matter?" He says, "Well, you know," and he pulls up his shirt.
Yeah.
He shot 6 times.
Oh, he was? Oh,
he
yeah.
was, and we, you know, of course, we tackled him, we fought with him, so he had blood on him, but we didn't know if most of the blood was coming from the wounds.
Okay.
So John, to this day, John doesn't know if his bullets hit him. I don't know if mine do, but we argue back and forth. You know, now it was mine, because we're still kidding around about that. So,
did you let him suffer for a while, or did you?
Well, we called the ambulance and we took him. And he survived all six rounds of ammunition. So,
man.
The district attorney, we're in court, and you know, of course, all the paperwork indicates that he was shot 6 times, and we were not shot, thank God. But
I see. And they started to ask, "Well, wait a minute, if you weren't
shot, yeah. even in those days." And the district attorney said to me, "I was so pissed off with this question." He says, "Well, you know." How come you shot him 6 times? And I says, "Well, Mr. DA, that's what my gun would hold."
You know, so. That's probably not the answer that you would hear on Law and Order.
You know,
yeah.
Even the complainant who owned the parking garage, he was probably followed from the bank into the parking garage, and that's where the stick-up went down. That's where the guy decided to stick him up off the street in the office. He was by himself in the parking garage on DeKalb Avenue, Brooklyn, downtown Brooklyn. But he was yelling and screaming. He kept saying the complaint to the DA, "If it wasn't for the assistant DA, if it wasn't for these guys, I wouldn't be here. They saved my life. And I know the district attorney at that time, I think it was Eugene Gold. I'll go right to him. If you indicate that you think these guys did anything wrong, I'll go to, I don't know if it was Mayor Koch or one of the mayors, and maybe Beam, and he said, my family knows the mayor," and then the ADA says, no, I just have to ask these questions, you know. So,
well, he does. I mean, that's his job, it's your job, it's the game, it's the dance you do, as a matter of course, of what you guys do. By the way, we're talking with Lou Talano. And he hosts a show called Streetwise on the Dave's Gone By station, WGBB. We'll have more with Lou coming up.
Hi, this is Lou Talano, and you're listening to Dave's Gone By on WGBB, 1240 AM. Dave Lefkowitz. And I speak Yiddish, and I had a... it's a shame, Dave Lefkowitz.
Speak Yiddish?
Yeah.
How do you speak Yiddish?
Well, yeah, I speak Yiddish because I was born in New York's Lower East Side,
uh-huh.
mixed area, and I did work a while for Rabbi Jacob Joseph School for Orphan and Refugee Jewish Children.
You're kidding me.
Yes, and was on East Broadway and Clinton Street, the whole Lower East Side. And you know, we talked about it before. I lived in the neighborhood on the Lower East Side, and we have reunions in Florida with guys that and gals from the neighborhood, and we talk about some of the things that interesting, colorful area. Is that if you walk into your building, which was not a project, we couldn't afford to live in a project. We lived in a tenement building. And in the tenement building, when you'd walk in there, you would smell the sauce from all the different pasta, right?
Right.
And then you would hear, you'll hear chopping. That's the people making gefilte fish. They would make, so in that building, and then you smell Greek food.
Oh,
and,
man.
Of course, in those days, you kept the doors open. Windows open, so walking into the building, you got hungry, you know. So, and intermingling, interacting with different nationalities, religions. So you pick up things, and since I was working at 14 years old for the school, I started as a messenger, and then I started answering phones, and then I started picking up Yiddish.
Wow.
So, which was helpful in you know, as on a job as a police officer. So
was it really? How many Yiddish people did you have to arrest?
No, it's not even that. You know, it's the victims. Keep in mind, my partner and I were assigned to Coney Island at one time, and we also assigned to my old neighbor, the Lower East Side, when they formed this Crimes Against the Elderly Squad. That's what we were in when they first created it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like anything else. If you interview the person and you say, like, for an example, this particular complainant, and many of them are old, Alta Yiddish.
Kakas, Alta Kakas.
I don't want to say Kakas, but Alta Kakas, okay. Alta Maidlas, whatever, you know. And I would say, Mamala Zugme, Vig Geister Trumpenik. And she'd say, oh, du bist da Yid? And I say, who then? You know? And they would open up. They'd feel comfortable. You know?
And not having a clue that you were Italian.
Yes.
I mean, you know, dyed in the wool at Milano, Italiano, yeah.
Interesting that you mentioned that, because in the same neighborhood on the Lower East Side, my name being Tolano, like you said,
mm-hmm.
and my first name being Lewis, which I don't know anybody calls me Lewis, thank God. You know, either Louis from the old neighborhood, or Lou when I was police officer, detective, and chief of police, or they'd call me chief, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But the guys, the Jewish guys I hung out with, they would call me, and you'll get a kick out of this, Label Talena.
Label Talena. Well, Talena is Tolano, right? Label for Lewis.
And Talena means Italian in Yiddish.
Oh, I might. Well, there you go. I didn't know that. I don't speak Yiddish. I used to speak a little Hebrew, but not so.
And they would say, like Louis the Italian, Label Talena.
Yeah.
You know, Label Talena.
Very sweet.
So, it's, you know, but some of the Jewish people I interviewed, they would say, you know what your name means in Yiddish? I said, yes, I do. You know, it means I'm a guy.
Well.
But I'm a good guy. There's bad guys and good guys. You know,
well,
so
that's going and guys. Yeah, well,
I know. I just use that. Cause
and there are Italian Jews too. I mean, there is such a thing.
As black Jews too.
A few.
Yes. You know, and there's all types. You know,
and there's orange Jews and tomato Jews and yeah.
Well, I'm reminded by my Jewish friends. You know, Jesus was a Jew. You know.
Yeah.
And I know what I say.
Life,
and I say, "Vuten."
You know? That's right. Where else could you have been at that point? Know. It wasn't a Mooney. Yeah.
Right. So.
How did we get on this? Okay.
Yeah, I know. we did. But.
You saw my face and said, Jew! And you talked.
But you started off wanting to interview me about different things, and somehow we drifted into this, which is okay.
No, that's cool.
You know, I'm going to be on your show. Doing something similar that we're doing now.
Right, in a couple of weeks, yeah.
Yes, and some of the things that I know, I peeked over your shoulder, I saw some of the questions that you want to ask. So
you are a detective still, okay.
I know some of the things that... so I'm going to just give the audience a preview what's going to happen on your show, is that some of the serious things have occurred, you know, with my partner and myself, and some of the funny things. And since we're talking about how I can speak a little Yiddish, tell you a story. If you recall, there was undercover anti-crime cops that dressed as Hasidims or dressed like rabbis. Yeah, we were one of the first, my partner and I. So
and you had an in, because even though you didn't speak Spanish, which is you spoke a little Yiddish.
I speak a little Spanish to get by, but I also speak a little Italian to get by, but not enough that they want to get into a whole big Megillah, so to speak, you know? So, but it's enough to say, where do you live, how old are you, what do you do for a living, you know, things like that, the basic stuff.
That's where I remember that from NYPD Blue. They had one of those episodes, they're on detail. It was Sipowicz and whoever, or may have even been, the one before, what was the, Hill Street Blues, probably.
Oh, Hill Street?
Renko and whatever.
Oh, yes.
As Cussids.
Right. See, you're older than you look.
Thank you.
You know.
And you look, yes, your hair is white, but it's good hair.
Okay.
And because you do the build and the thing, I mean, you showed me a picture of you pressing weights for...
That was in the book, the Police Olympics.
Right.
Yeah.
I didn't know there was a Police Olympics.
Yeah, and in fact, it's national. The ones that, if there's any event you could think of, boxing, judo, karate, volleyball, baseball, I was in what they call powerlifting, which is weightlifting. And that was my hobby for 100 years. And
what did you do? What was your...
Well, I want to say this. In 19... Oh, should I say the year?
Go ahead.
1976 and 1977... I won the silver medal in New York. When I say New York, keep in mind, every police department in the state of New York competes in this.
Oh, wow.
In different weight categories. So 76 and 77, I won the silver. Before that, I won about 4 or 5 bronze medals. And I couldn't understand why some of these guys kept winning the gold medal. And I said, I know I'm strong as them, or as strong as them, or stronger than them, but I couldn't win the gold medal. Years later, I found out even cops were doing steroids. They were doing the anabolic steroids.
Well, I guess it wasn't illegal, come to think of it.
No, it really wasn't. You know, but I was so... I had a different, different ideas about working out. You know, no smoking, no drinking, of course, which they didn't do either. You know, high protein, all that stuff. And when I had a headache, I wouldn't want to even take aspirins. So, to put a needle in my butt was nowhere No way in the world I was going to do that. But I found out years later, these guys were doing anabolic steroids. But I also competed nationally, because if you win the top 3 medals in New York State in every weight category, in every event, you compete against the West Coast cops.
Cool.
Which is, when they say West Coast, they throw in Florida, Arizona,
not very
California.
West,
I know, but they throw
Key
in the
West, maybe.
The warm climate, so to speak, as opposed to the East Coast.
You know, that brought up something totally out there, and maybe you don't necessarily want to talk about it, but it does get kind of interesting, the mention of the steroids being, I mean, it's not even illegal to use except in sports, because it's illegal for sports, not, I guess, against the law per se. But did you ever run into a Serpico sort of situation of seeing your fellow officers, your fellow people, doing something significant? I'm not talking about little stuff, but significantly wrong?
Well, I have to be careful what I say,
sure.
even though but the statute of limitations is long gone in my case. So, to answer your question, there were some guys doing some things,
Don't have to mention names, but did you do and how did you...
The Knapp Commission was in those years, and they were prosecuting, indicting, and, of course, before arresting police officers. So I knew some of those guys that were arrested. Yes, and, you mentioned Serpico, but the person that allegedly shot Serpico is really not the person that shot him. How I know is that his name was Mambo, and this guy was a meek drug dealer. He was so afraid, he wouldn't even carry a gun. This guy did not shoot Serpico, the one who was arrested for it. If you grabbed him in the street, and that's how I first met him, I was able to cop dope from him, dressed as Tonto. I was able to purchase narcotics from him.
You're talking about the meek little Nebbish who got pinned for the
exactly,
rat. Exactly. Yeah.
Right. The cleaner Nebbish, like you said. He'd give up his grandmother. But somehow, he's the guy that's accused, when they made this raid, of shooting Frank Serpico, and I know he didn't shoot him. You know.
So what are you implying?
I'm implying that. Well, obviously it smells. Now, maybe another cop shot him. Maybe somebody else shot him. I don't know. Maybe Serpico set it up himself. He was always suspect. This guy, you know. You know, my question to Serpico is that if you know a certain particular unit is dirty, which you know, corrupt, getting corrupt, why would you want to go in it? Why would you want to be part of it? And he did. He wanted to force himself into this particular unit. Now, in those days, I'm going to tell you what the general thought was. Hear no evil, see no evil, and do no evil as a cop, you know? You don't have to get involved in it, which we didn't, right? But you don't have to give up the person, which they want you to. And I'm going to tell you, I don't want to tell you about what my partner and I did, but if they do it, you're not going to talk them out of it if these guys are willing and dealing. You know, when I say these guys, the cops.
Yeah.
You're not going to convince them. You're not going to sit down like a priest or rabbi and say, you know, this is a sin, this is bad. You know, you stay away from them, and you pretty much ignore it. But ignoring it is good because you don't know the details of what they're doing. But you know they're doing something, and you know they're doing it. So the question to Frank Serpico is, why would you want to get involved? Why would you want to do this? He could have been a detective like the way my partner was. Go out and arrest bad guys. Yeah, you can let somebody else arrest bad cops. Yeah, you're supposed to give him up. But he put himself in a position where it appeared like he wanted to do it. And how did he get his gold shield? And that's the expression. You become a detective from being a police officer. He got it when he was shot. He was promoted while he was laying in the hospital bed.
You're talking about
Frank Serpico.
Yeah, right.
He was given his gold shield while he was shot. Not to anything that he did. He didn't do a damn thing, this guy. He just had a long hair and a beard. That's the extent of it.
Well, it's like a Purple Heart. I mean, if you get shot in the line of duty...
Absolutely, but you don't get promoted to detective. You know, what did he do? Who did he apprehend? What was the case? Nobody else got promoted.
Well, maybe the department wanted to promote him as way of having him like the police more and go after criminals instead of criminals in the police department.
Well, he never did that because he retired. That was payback. So, you know, for giving up cops.
Well, yes, it was. Obviously, it was.
That's what it was. So,
well, you have to admit, it may have been not a nice thing to do, since these were your brothers, but it was a brave thing to do. Probably braver than going out on the street at some point and knocking around a drug dealer.
In those days, it could be.
Probably these days, too.
But, pretty much, but, you know, it's the way of life in the police department. You know, it's just, you just don't do certain things. You don't have to be involved with that. And, you know, and the cops that were arrested and indicted, by the way, Najari pretty much indicted many cops, but he only got, I think, 10% convictions. Najari was there running the NAP commission at the time, the prosecutor. He only got like 10% conviction rate in that. So,
I'm not just wanting to pull this into like the 1970s and right. I mean, you've got those two guys. Now, during time, those two cops who shot those people, they were working, I think, for the mob in a way. I'm sorry, I'm blanking on the details.
No.
I mean, this is recent. This is when in the past year they were convicted.
Yes,
I mean, these guys were
bad guys.
Assumedly evil.
Evil guys, and they should do at least life. My
who
opinion.
Was the one to go out there and get them?
You know, that's more recent than my time, and I happen to know these guys. And
personally?
Oh yeah, bumped each other. I worked with one of them. I worked with his brother, who was a detective, who actually retired as a police inspector. I don't want to go into names, but
people can look up the names of these two people,
yes,
these two cops. Yeah,
his brother retired as a deputy police inspector, who I worked with when I was a detective. So, I still talk to a lot of, you know, police officers, and we all agree that these guys are bad news. And again, if they gave them the death penalty, if they can prove that they committed homicides, which I believe they did, you know, and it wouldn't bother me if they received the death penalty. But again, they're sort of isolated cases.
Well, yeah, I mean, nobody's saying that it's 30% of the police force,
right.
Or even 10.
Right.
And just if it doesn't get rooted out from within, then who's to necessarily root it out until God knows how much longer it goes on? That's all.
Absolutely. But, you know, anyway, what else, Dad? You're interviewing me.
Okay, move on to some happier stuff.
Hi, this is Lou Talano, and you're listening to Dave's Gone By on WGBB 1240 AM.
By the way, you ran for political office at one point. You were running for, was it Congress?
I ran for Congress, right.
I mean, you didn't win, but how did it go?
Yeah. I went pretty good.
Yeah.
I won the primary, which is good. And, you know, I was involved with Rudy Giuliani. I was his law enforcement liaison, and I put together his first security advance. And then some of the politicians said, you know, Louie, make a good politician, or make a good congressman. You know, why don't you run for Congress? And I did. I ran Brooklyn, Queens as a congressman. I'm a registered Democrat.
What? Really?
Yes.
That's a shock.
But I'm conservative. I'm very conservative.
Okay.
You know, in fact, my viewpoints for years are pretty close to being a Republican. Because I believe in the death penalty, things like that.
All right.
And I definitely don't agree with liberalism. When I say liberalism, I think I'm a liberal, because I think people that harm children and rape and murder senior citizens should get the death penalty, you know? So that's being liberal. I'm compassionate to these people. So, these victims, I should say.
I'm not sure I disagree with you on the death penalty, but it's certainly a conservative view to agree with the death penalty.
Yes, that's what I meant. So I'm more of a conservative, even though I'm a registered Democrat. But I jumped into a primary. A Democratic primary, and four or five guys who were already councilmen, councilwomen, and assemblymen were running for Chuck Schumer's vacant seat. It was up for grabs.
Wow.
So I jumped in.
This is how long ago?
I guess 10 years ago now.
Okay.
You know, or 9 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, and I jumped in into the primary, and then all of them got together, which they all hate each other, and challenged my petitions to get me off the ballot. And it was successful, because I couldn't afford to respond to each individual particular
How many signatures did you need, or something like that?
I think I think 1,500 or... No, I needed more than that.
Hmm.
2,500. And I had them, but they challenged them. So I dropped out. And when I dropped out, the Republican Party called me.
Huh.
Because I'm going to tell you this. With my last name, I got the endorsement from the Jewish Post and the Jewish Press.
Because it was Italian and Jewish.
You know, and besides all the other union endorsements, civil service endorsements, and I was doing good fundraising. And they asked me to run as their Republican candidate against Anthony Weiner, who won the Democratic primary. And P.S., you know what happened with that. Because I ran in the Democratic area. But they tell me I got more votes than Mayor LaGuardia did. As a Republican candidate. But I did very well running.
Did you like politics, or is it just like, ugh?
Actually, both. How do you say both? You like it, and it is ugh.
Right.
You know?
Well, what was the ugh part? I mean, did you already, even though you didn't win, I mean, did you find yourself making compromises that you didn't,
you know,
or shaking hands of people that you had to wash afterwards?
You know, everyone has a dream, you know? And I had a dream that I would be, and I still do, it's more of a reality, that I would be on like the old Untouchable movie, or that they had the Untouchables on television. I think I would be hated by everyone, because I think I would be an untouchable congressman.
Huh.
You know, and that was my belief. Uh-huh. You know, you couldn't schmear me, you know, right? You know, and you're not going to corrupt me. So I'm going to do what I think is best for everyone. You know, it's...
I mean, that was actually the idea probably of Bloomberg coming in. He had so much money that the idea was that he could do and be his own man just because no one could pay him off, or he had all the money, and money wasn't a factor in his running. So at least that was the idealized version of what Bloomberg was supposed to be coming in as mayor.
Absolutely right. And Ed Koch was like that. Hmm. Ed Koch was very wealthy in his own right.
Right.
And you couldn't touch him with money. You know, and when I say touch it, you know, they do it different ways. It's campaign donations, contributions, whatever you want to call it. There's other ways that what they do in politics in this country. So, But the mistake he made was he had trust in his commissioners, mm-hmm. and they were corrupt. I shouldn't generalize, but many of them were corrupt. Okay. And that was sort of pretty much a downfall in his case.
Well, any codified crime. I mean, New York went downhill and financially. And
actually,
in a lot of ways.
It went downhill with David Dinkins. As far as
much worse. I mean, it started as like a little gravel slide, and then it just became literally like a.
He was the worst mayor in New York City has ever had. So no two ways about it. The worst, you know, and the dumbest. You know?
Wow.
And that's a fact.
You have a picture with him, you know.
he was smart. He came to. I had a dinner, and I said something about him in the newspapers. When I was campaigning for Giuliani, I was interviewed on the steps of City Hall, and I made a statement that if David Dinkins becomes mayor of the city of New York, the city will see the worst crime wave in New York City history. And it happened. So he's being a good politician. I say he's dumb. Being a good politician, he did like most politicians did. Don't talk to your enemies. Try to make friends with them. So I had a major fraternal order of police event in New York, and he stopped by. He stopped by, and he's the mayor of the city of New York.
Absolutely.
So, of course,
politics makes.
And he's the mayor of the city of New York. So, of course, I had to acknowledge him, introduce him, acknowledge him, and whatever, and took pictures together. You know. So, I don't know. I think if someone said that about me, I hate them forever. But you know.
If you like the laughs I bring you every week on Dave's Gone By, I'll bet you'll like my book a whole lot, too. It's called Marriage, Babies, and the End of the World, full of short and funny plays about everything from blind dates to dead people to a bowl of prunes. Marriage, Babies, and the End of the World, available from Holvo Books on my website, davesgoneby.org. Makes a great gift, and the laughs are on me. You know, we have just a couple more minutes with your show with Lou Talano here, and I did want to ask. You had mentioned this to me at one point, and I was just like, "Whoa!" Because I know you're a retired detective and all the jobs you used to do when you were chief of police of Seagate, but then you had mentioned something about going to like foreign governments or with the military or something like that.
Well, actually, I was an advisor. You know, I just can't go into details with. Afghanistan and Iraq is this private security company hired me to help recruit and interview the potential police officers for Iraq and Afghanistan.
Good. So, now, did you do that here, or did you go to Iraq and Afghanistan?
I think I can't talk about that for 2 years, and it's only like a year ago, so I have another year to pretty much talk about it. I could say as much as that I did what I did, and I can't say where it was. But there was a screening process that I was involved in recruiting. I didn't like it, by the way. So it was a year commitment. I didn't do a year. So,
okay. I mean, what didn't you like? Or can you not say what you didn't like about it?
Well, you talk about Serpico and not trusting police officers. Yeah. I didn't trust the people I was interviewing. You know, I had the feeling that a lot of them, some of them doing for the money. I didn't get good vibes. I didn't get good feelings with them. And I could see where some of these guys could be infiltrators, not to be corny and all possible terrorists, you know. And, of course, that was my opinion. That was the conclusion of my interview, is that you got to keep an eye on them, and I don't trust them, you know. And the ones I interviewed, and I was interviewing pretty much the ones that was, since I was a chief for the New York City Sheriff's Department, and a chief, like you mentioned, Seagate. And I did investigations on police officers as a detective, applicant investigations, things like that. Anyway, I would interview potential supervisors in those police departments, and I didn't get good vibes. And
But let's say you had a good candidate. What would be the difference between being a police officer or chief here, and what would you look for someone who was going to be out in a freaking war zone?
You can't. You know, you're dealing with different mentality.
Right.
You're dealing, we come from America. We have different values. Many of them, I didn't feel they had any values. Ooh. You know, they have no problem. They wouldn't have any. The feeling that I got is that they're just as bad as a terrorist. I felt they'd have no problem cutting your throat. You know.
Right.
They'd have no problem torturing you, and they'd have no problem strapping dynamite on themselves and killing themselves. So how do you deal with people like that?
You make them New York City school teachers. No, I'm kidding. I'm just kidding.
Bring him into the New York City Police Department now.
No, I wouldn't. You can make that joke. If I make that joke, you'd break my arm. But Lou Talano, I guess we should wrap up. But it's been fabulous talking to you.
Well, we talked about some of the things, Dave. Thank you. It was a great idea that you had.
Thank you.
Something different.
Yeah.